than you was pumping. So strong, you
all beautiful, know what it is. All beautiful, it's a boy, it's a king. It's a spirit of praise. I believe your boys are serious time, baby. We never gonna stop. Hip hop music, we're taking over. Free time on beyond. I'm out, baby. I'm out, baby. I'm out, baby.
Yeah. Thank you. Children on the Highway. I heard the wagons rolling past the garden fence. Sometimes I also glimpsed them through the faintly stirring gaps in the foliage. How loudly the wood in their spokes and shafts groaned in the hot summer. Farmhands were coming from the fields, laughing outrageously. I sat on our small swing, just relaxing among the trees in my parents' garden. Beyond the fence, the bustle never stopped. Children ran by in the space of a moment. Grain wagons, with men and women on the sheaves or around them, darkened the flower beds. Toward evening, I saw a leisurely strolling gentleman with a cane, and a couple of girls, coming toward him arm in arm, stepped aside into the grass as they greeted him. Then birds soared up in a sparkling spray. I followed them with my eyes, saw them rising for an instant until I believed that they were no longer rising, but that I was falling, and clutching the ropes because I felt faint, I began to swing a little. Soon I was swinging harder as cooler air began to waft and trembling stars appeared overhead instead of the soaring birds. I was served my supper by candlelight. Often both my arms lay on the wooden tabletop, and I was already weary as I bit into my bread and butter. The large meshed curtains bellied in the warm wind, and at times some passerby held them apart with his hands if he wanted to see me more clearly and talk to me. Usually the candle soon went out, and the gathered midges flitted about for a while in the dark candle fumes. If anyone at the window asked me something, I would gaze at him as if peering at the mountains or simply into the air, and he likewise didn't much care whether I answered. But if anyone then vaulted over the windowsill and announced that the others were already in front of the house, I would stand up, sighing, of course.
"Goodness, why are you sighing? What has happened? Is it some special misfortune that can never be made good again? Will we never be able to recover? Is everything truly lost?"
Nothing was lost. We ran to the front of the house.
"Thank goodness you're finally here. Well, you're always late." "What do you mean I'm always late?" "You more than anyone else. Stay home if you don't want to join us."
"No mercy."
"What? No mercy? What are you saying?"
We poked our heads into the evening. There was no daytime and no nighttime. At times our vest buttons were grinding together like teeth. At times we kept a steady gap between us as we ran, with fire in our mouths like beasts in the tropics. Like cuirassiers in ancient wars, stamping and leaping high in the air, we drove one another down the short street, and then, with this urging in our legs, into the highway. A few stray people ran into the ditch. No sooner had they melted into the dark embankment than they were already standing on the dirt road like outsiders and peering down.
"Come on down. Come on up first. So you can throw us down? Not on your life. We're not that stupid."
"You mean you're that cowardly. Come on now, come up."
"Really? You of all people are going to throw us down? Says who?"
We mounted the attack, were sent sprawling, and collapsed on the grass in the road ditch, falling of our own free will. Everything was evenly warmed. We felt no heat, no cold in the grass. We only grew tired. When you turned on your right side, with your hand under your ear, you felt very much like dozing off. You did want to pull yourself up, raising your chin, but only to tumble into a deeper ditch. Then, holding your arm out crosswise and flapping your legs to the side, you wanted to throw yourself against the air and be certain to tumble into an even deeper ditch, and you never wanted to stop. You hardly thought about how you might properly stretch out your body, especially your knees, as far as possible. To sleep in the final ditch, and on the verge of weeping, you lay on your back as if ill. People winked whenever a boy, his elbows at his hips, leaped over us with dark soles from the embankment to the road. The moon could already be seen fairly high. A mail wagon drove past in its light. A mild breeze arose all about. You could feel it even in the ditch, and the nearby woods began to rustle. You were no longer so anxious to be alone.
"Where are you? Come here. All of us together. Why are you hiding? Stop your nonsense.
Don't you realize that the mail wagon has already passed?"
"Oh, no, already passed?
Of course, it passed by while you were asleep."
"I was asleep? Imagine that."
"Shush, one can tell just by looking at you."
"Oh, go on.
Come."
We ran closer together. Some of us held hands. We couldn't keep our heads high enough because the road descended. Someone let out an Indian war whoop. A gallop shot into our legs as never before. Whenever we leaped, the wind would lift us by our hips. Nothing could have stopped us. We were running so hard that even when passing one another, we managed to fold our arms and calmly look around. We halted at the bridge spanning the mountain torrent. Those who had run further doubled back. The water below smashed against rocks and roots as if it were not already late in the evening. There was no reason why no one jumped up to the balustrade of the bridge. In the distance, a railroad train emerged from behind some shrubbery. All the compartments were lit. The glass windows were probably down. One of us began singing a popular hit, but we all wanted to sing. We sang much faster than the train moved. We swung our arms because our voices weren't strong enough. Our voices formed a scrimmage in which we felt cozy. If you blend your voice with other voices, you are virtually caught on a fishhook. And so, with our backs to the forest, we sang for the ears of the distant travelers. The adults were still awake in the village. The mothers were making up the beds for the night. It was already time. I kissed the one standing next to me, casually shook hands with the three nearest ones, and began to run back. No one called out to me. At the first crossroads, where they could no longer see me, I turned off and ran back into the forest along dirt roads. I was heading toward the southern city which our villagers talk about. "There are people there. Just imagine, they don't sleep." "And why not?" "Because they don't get sleepy." "And why not?" "Because they're fools." "Don't fools get sleepy?" "How could fools get sleepy?" Exposing a City Slicker. Finally, around 10 at night, together with a man whom I had once known only casually, and who had unexpectedly joined me this time, dragging me around the streets for 2 hours, I arrived at the elegant mansion where I had been invited to a soiree. "Well," I said, clapping my hands as a sign that it was absolutely necessary to say good night. I had already made a few less pointed attempts. By now I was quite exhausted.
"Are you going right up?"
he asked. From his mouth, I heard a sound like clicking teeth. "Yes." I did have an invitation. I had told him so immediately. Indeed, I had been invited to go upstairs to a place where I would love to be, and not down here, standing outside the front door and gazing past my interlocutor's ears. Or now going mute with him as if we were determined to linger on this spot for a long time. The houses all around us promptly took part in this silence, as did the darkness above them all the way up to the stars. And the footfalls of invisible strollers, whose routes one did not care to guess. The wind, which kept hugging the opposite side of the street. A gramophone, which sang against the closed windows of some room or other. They sounded from this silence as if it had always been and would forever remain their property. My companion resigned himself on his behalf, and also, after a smile, on my behalf, stretched his right arm upward along the wall, and, closing his eyes, leaned his face against it. But I did not wait until this smile faded, for embarrassment suddenly whirled me around. This was the smile that had first made me realize he was a city slicker, pure and simple. And yet I had been in this town for months already, believing I knew these city slickers through and through. The way they come toward us at night from side streets, holding out their hands like innkeepers, the way they squeeze around the advertisement pillars where we stand, the way they virtually play hide-and-seek, spying on us with at least one eye from behind the curve of the pillar, the way they suddenly hover before us when we grow anxious at street corners on the curb of the sidewalk. I did understand them so well. After all, they were my first local acquaintances in the small taverns, and I owed them my first inkling of an adamant character which I could so little imagine as missing from the earth that I was already starting to feel it inside myself. The way they stood facing you, even when you had long since slipped away from them, when there was absolutely nothing left for you to be tricked out of. The way they refused to sit down, refused to drop down, but instead looked at you with glances that were still convincing, albeit only from far away. And their methods were always the same. They planted themselves in front of us as broadly as they could, trying to hold us back from where we were heading, preparing a substitute home for us in their own bosoms. And when the throttled feelings finally surged in us, they welcomed them as an embrace into which they threw themselves face first. This time I had seen through these old tricks only after we had spent so much time together. I rubbed my fingertips sore to wipe away the disgrace. My companion, however, was still leaning there as before, still thinking of himself as a city slicker, and his satisfaction with his destiny was making his exposed cheek turn red. "You've got me," I said, patting him on the back. Then I quickly mounted the steps, and the so groundlessly devoted faces of the domestics up in the vestibule delighted me like a lovely surprise. I looked at each one in turn as they removed my coat and dusted my boots. Then, heaving a sigh of relief, I loped into the parlor. Decisions. Lifting oneself from a miserable state of mind ought to be easy, even by sheer willpower. I wrench myself out of the chair, walk around the table, loosen my head and my neck, drive fire into my eyes, flex the muscles around them, work against any feelings, exuberantly greet A if he turns up now, amiably tolerate B in my room, inhale all of C's words in long drafts, despite my strain and suffering. But even if I can manage like that, any mistake, and mistakes are inevitable, will bring everything, light or heavy, to a halt, and I will have to twist back into my circle again. Hence the best course is to put up with everything, behave like a heavy mass, and even if you feel blasted away, not be inveigled into taking any unnecessary step. Gaze at the other with animal eyes, feel no remorse. In short, push down with your own hands any ghost of life surviving in you. Increase, that is, the final grave-like rest, and let nothing else exist. A characteristic movement in such a state of mind is to run the little finger over the eyebrows. The outing in the mountains. I don't know, I cried in a toneless voice. I just don't know. If nobody comes, well, then nobody comes. I've hurt nobody. Nobody's hurt me, yet nobody wants to help me. A bunch of nobodies. But that's not the way it is, except that nobody's helping me. Otherwise, a bunch of nobodies would be just fine. I would love to, and why not, go on an outing with a bunch of absolute nobodies. Into the mountains, naturally, where else? How these nobodies crowd and jostle, those many arms jutting out at an angle and linked together, those countless feet separated by tiny steps, all of them, needless to say, in tailcoats. We walk along, free and easy. The wind blows through the gaps left open by ourselves and our limbs. Our throats become free in the mountains. It's a miracle that we do not sing. The Bachelor's Unhappiness. It seems so awful to remain a bachelor, an old man barely keeping up his dignity when asking to be received if he wishes to spend an evening with other people, being sick and gazing at the empty room for weeks on end from the bed corner, always saying good night at the front door, never squeezing up the stairs next to his wife, having a room with only side doors that lead into other apartments, carrying home his supper in one hand, having to admire other people's children and not being allowed to constantly repeat, "I have none," modeling his appearance and behavior on those of one or two bachelors he recalls from his youth. That's how it will be. Except that in reality, one will also stand there oneself, today and later, with a body and a real head, hence also a forehead, to beat one's hand on it. The Businessman. It may be that a few people are sorry for me, but I don't sense it. My small shop fills me with worries, making my forehead and temples ache, but offering no prospects of contentment, for my shop is small. For hours in advance I have to make decisions, keep the errand boy's memory alert, warn against mistakes that I dread, and during one season figure out which fashions will be in vogue the next, not among people in my circle, but among inaccessible populaces in the countryside. My money is in the hands of strangers. Their circumstances are beyond my ken. I have no inkling of the misfortune that could strike them. How could I ward it off? Perhaps they have become spendthrifts and are hosting a party in a tavern garden, and others are attending this party for a brief moment before fleeing to America. Now, when my shop closes on a workday evening, and I am suddenly faced with hours in which I can do no work for the incessant needs of my business, then my agitation, a distant harbinger every morning, tosses inside me like a returning tide. But it cannot endure being inside me, and it sweeps me away without a goal. And then I have no use whatsoever for this mood, and all I can do is go home, for my face and hands are dirty and sweaty, my clothes are stained and dusty, with my shop cap on my head and my boots scratched up by the nails of crates. I then walk as if on waves, drumming with the fingers of both hands and stroking the hair of passing children. But the distance is too short. Soon I am inside my building, opening the elevator door and stepping in. I see that now I am suddenly alone. Others who must climb stairs, grow slightly tired, have to wait with hurriedly breathing lungs for someone to come and open the apartment door, giving them good reason to be annoyed and impatient. They now enter the vestibule, where they hang up their hats, and they are not alone until they walk through the corridor past several French doors and get into their own rooms. I, however, am instantly alone in the elevator, and propped on my knees, I gaze into the narrow mirror. When the elevator starts rising, I say, "Keep quiet, step back. Do you want to melt into the shade of the trees, behind the draperies on the windows, into the vault of the bower?"
I talk through my teeth. And the staircase landings glide down the frosted panes like cascading water. Fly away. Your wings, which I have never seen, may carry you to the village valley or to Paris if you feel an urge to go there. But enjoy the view through the window when the processions converge from all three streets, not shifting aside for each other, but passing through one another, and letting the square emerge free again as their final ranks march off. Wave your handkerchiefs, be indignant, be moved. Praise the beautiful lady driving past. Walk across the wooden bridge spanning the brook, nod at the swimming children, and marvel at the hurrah rising from the thousand sailors on the distant battleship. Just follow the inconspicuous man, and when you have shoved him into a doorway, rob him and then watch him, each of you with his hands in his pockets, as he sadly goes his way into the left-hand street. The scattered policemen galloping on their horses rein in their animals and push you back. Let them. The empty streets will make them unhappy. I know they will. They are already riding away two by two, if you please, slowly rounding the street corners, speeding across the squares. Then I have to get out. Send the elevator back down, ring the apartment bell, and the maid opens the door while I say, "Good evening." Absently gazing out. What will we do in these spring days that are now hurrying toward us? This morning the sky was gray, but if you go to the window now, you are surprised and you lean your cheek against the window latch. The sun is already setting, of course, but down below you see its light on the face of the childlike girl who is just strolling and looking about. And at the same time you see the man's shadow upon her as he hurries up behind her. And then the man has passed her, and the child's face is utterly bright. The way home. Just look how persuasive the air is after the thunderstorm. My merits appear to me and overpower me, although admittedly I offer no resistance. I march along, and my tempo is the tempo of this side of the street, this neighborhood. I am rightfully responsible for all the knocks on doors, on tabletops, for all toasts, for the lovers in their beds, in the skeletons of the new buildings, pressed against the house walls in dark alleys, or on the ottomans of bordellos. I assess my past against my future, but find both of them excellent. I can give neither one the preference, and I can carp only at the inequity of Providence, which has favored me in this way. It is only upon entering my room that I get to thinking, although without having found anything worth thinking about while climbing the stairs. It doesn't help me much if I open the window all the way, and the music is still playing in some garden. The people running by. When we stroll through a street at night, and a man, already visible from far away, for the street rises in front of us and there is a full moon, comes running toward us, we will not grab hold of him. Even if he is weak and ragged, even if someone is running after him and yelling, we will simply let him run on. For it's night, and we cannot help it if the street rises in front of us in the full moon. And besides, perhaps these two people are staging the chase for their own amusement. Perhaps the two of them are pursuing a third. Perhaps the first man is being pursued through no fault of his own. Perhaps the second one wants to murder him, and we will be accomplices to the murder. Perhaps the two of them know nothing of one another, and each is simply running home to bed on his own account. Perhaps they are sleepwalkers. Perhaps the first man is armed. And anyway, don't we have the right to be tired? Haven't we drunk a lot of wine? We're glad that we no longer see the second one either.
the passenger. I stand on the platform of the trolley car, and am completely insecure about my footing in this world, in this city, in my family. Nor could I indicate even casually what demands I might rightfully make in any direction. In no way can I defend myself for standing on this platform, clutching this strap, letting this trolley carry me along, defend people for scurrying out of the way or walking quietly or window shopping. Of course, no one is asking me for a defense, but that's beside the point. The trolley approaches a stop. A girl comes over to the steps, ready to get out. She is as obvious to me as if I had run my fingers over her. She's wearing black. The pleats of her skirt barely stir. Her blouse is snug and has a collar of white, fine-meshed lace. Her left hand is propped flat against the side of the trolley. The umbrella in her right hand is poised on the second step from the top. Her face is brown. Her nose, slightly pinched on the sides, has a broad, round tip. She has a lot of brown hair, and small, stray hairs on her right temple. Her small ear lies close to her head, but by standing near her, I can see the entire ridge of her right ear conch and the shadow at its root. I wondered back then, how come she's not astonished at herself? How come she keeps her mouth shut and says nothing along those lines? Frocks. Often when I see frocks with manifold pleats, ruffles, and ornaments fitting so beautifully on beautiful bodies, I think they will not remain that way for long. Instead, they'll develop wrinkles that cannot be ironed out. Thick, unremovable dust will settle in the adornments, and no girl will want to appear so dismal and ridiculous as to slip into the same precious frock early in the morning and take it off at night. Still, I see girls who are certainly beautiful and display many attractive muscles and small bones and taut skin and masses of fine hair, and yet they sport that same natural masquerade day after day, always propping that same face on the same palms and letting their mirrors reflect it. It is only on some nights, when they come home late from a party, that the frock looks frayed in the mirror, puffy, dusty, already seen by everyone, and scarcely to be worn again. The rejection. Whenever I meet a beautiful girl and ask her, please come with me, do, and she walks on without a word, her drift is, you are no duke with a soaring name, no four-square American with an Indian stature, with level eyes, with a skin massaged by the air of grasslands and the rivers flowing through them. You have never traveled to or on the great seas, which are goodness knows where. So please tell me, why should a beautiful girl like me go with you? You are forgetting that no automobile carries you through the streets, rocking in long sweeps. I see no retinue of gentlemen pressed into their clothes, blessing you in murmurs, walking behind you in a precise semicircle. Your breasts are snugly laced in your corset, but your thighs and hips make up for that abstinence. You are wearing a pleated taffeta dress, the kind that certainly delighted all of us last autumn, and yet from time to time you smile. That mortal danger emanating from your body.
Well, we are both right. And rather than having it dawn on us irrefutably, don't you think that each of us should really go home alone?
Reflections for amateur jockeys. Nothing, once you think about it,
could tempt you to be the winner of a race. When the orchestra strikes up, the glory of being hailed as the best horseman in a country is too delightful to prevent remorse from setting in the next morning. The envy of our opponents, cunning and rather influential men, is bound to cause us pain in the narrow enclosure through which we ride after that vast expanse of the race course, which soon stretched out empty before us, except for a few straggling riders from the previous round, who were tiny now as they charged toward the edge of the horizon. Many of our friends are hurrying to collect their winnings, and so they merely shout their hurrahs to us over their shoulders from the distant betting window. Our best friends, however, did not even bet on our horse, for they feared that if they were to lose, they would be angry at us. But now that our horse has come in first, and they have won nothing, they turn away as we pass, and they prefer to gaze along the stands. Our rivals behind us, steady in their saddles, are trying to overlook the misfortune that has struck them and the injustice that is somehow being done to them. They are putting on cheerful expressions, as if a new race had to begin, and a serious one after such child's play. Many women find the winner ridiculous because he struts about and yet can't cope with the endless handshaking, saluting, bowing, and distant waving, while the losers have shut their mouths and are casually patting the necks of their mostly whinnying horses. Eventually, the sky clouds over, and it actually starts raining. The window facing the street. If a person leads a desolate life, and yet would care for some sort of company now and again, if, depending on the changes in the time of day, the weather, his work schedule, and the like, he suddenly wishes to see an arm, any arm, to cling to, that person will not get by for long without a window facing the street. And if he is in no mood to look for anything, and, being tired, merely steps over to his windowsill, his eyes darting up and down between the public and the sky, and wants none of it, and tilts his head back slightly, then the horses down below will nevertheless yank him down into their retinue of vehicles and hubbub, and thus finally toward human harmony. The wish to be an Indian. If only one were an Indian, ever alert, and leaning into the wind on a speeding horse, always jerkily quivering over the quivering ground, until one dropped one's spurs, for there would be no spurs, until one hurled away one's reins, for there would be no reins, and one barely saw the countryside before one as a smoothly mown heath. But now, without the horse's neck and horse's head. The trees. For we are like tree trunks in the snow. They seem to be resting smoothly, as if one could push them away with a slight nudge. No, one cannot, for they are firmly attached to the ground. But lo and behold, this too is sheer semblance. Unhappiness. One evening, when I could endure it no longer, it was in November, and I was dashing around the narrow carpet of my room as if it were a racetrack, and, startled by the sight of the illuminated street, I turned away, yet found a new goal in the depth of the room, in the chasm of the mirror, and I shrieked merely in order to hear the shriek to which nothing responds, which nothing can deprive of the power of shrieking, and which, consequently, rises unhampered and cannot stop even if it fades out. The door flew open out of the wall, and so hastily, because haste was necessary, and even the cart horses down below on the roadway reared like horses maddened in a battle, baring their throats. Like a small ghost, a child swept in from the pitch-dark corridor where the lamp was not yet burning, and he remained on tiptoe, on an imperceptibly swaying floorboard. Instantly blinded by the twilight in the room, he was about to quickly cover his face with his hands, but then unexpectedly calmed down at the sight of the window, where, beyond the crossbars, the high-swept vapor of the streetlight had finally settled beneath the darkness. Propping his right elbow against the wall of the room, he held himself upright in the open doorway, letting the draft from outside play around his ankles, and also his neck, and also his temples. Eyeing him briefly, I then said, "Good day," and removed my robe from the stove screen because I didn't care to stand there half naked. For a short while I kept my lips open to release my agitation through my mouth. I had a sour taste in my mouth. My eyelashes fluttered in my face. In short, that visit, although expected, was simply the last straw. The child was still standing in the same place, by the wall. He had pressed his right hand against its surface, and, with red cheeks, he simply couldn't get enough of the fact that the whitewashed plaster had a coarse grain which chafed his fingertips. I said, "Are you sure it is I you are looking for? Could you be mistaken?" "There's nothing easier than making a mistake in this large building. My name is so-and-so. I live on the third landing. Am I the person you wish to visit?" "Quiet, quiet," said the child over his shoulder. "It's all correct." "Then come further into the room. I'd like to close the door."
"I've just closed the door. Don't bother. Just calm down."
"It's no bother. But a lot of people live along this corridor, and naturally we're all acquainted. Most of them are coming home from their jobs now. If they hear someone talking in a room, they simply feel they have the right to open their doors and check what's going on. That's just the way it is. These people have their daily work behind them, and they won't knuckle under to anybody in their provisional evening freedom. Besides, you're quite aware of that. Let me close the door." "Why, what's wrong? What's the matter with you? The whole building can come for all I care, and let me repeat, I've already closed the door. Do you believe you're the only person who can close it? I've even turned the key." "Well, fine, that's all I want. You didn't need to turn the key. And now that you're here, do make yourself comfortable. You are my guest. You must trust me completely. Make yourself at home. Don't be shy. I won't force you to stay or to leave. Need I say so? Don't you know me by now?" "No, you really didn't need to say so. In fact, you shouldn't have said so. I'm a child. Why all this fuss and bother?"
"It's not as bad as all that. Of course, a child, but
you're not that little. You're quite grown up. If you were a girl, you couldn't just simply lock yourself up in a room with me." "We don't have to worry about that. I only wanted to say that my knowing you so well offers me little protection. It merely relieves you of the effort to tell me lies. Nevertheless, you are paying me compliments. Do stop. I demand that you stop. Besides, I can't recognize you everywhere and every time, least of all in this darkness. It would be much better if you made some light. No, never mind. In any case, I'll remember that you've already threatened me."
"What? I threatened you? Now look here. I'm so glad you're finally here. I say finally because it's already so late. I simply don't understand why you've come so late. Perhaps I was so overjoyed that I inadvertently said things I shouldn't have said, and you took them amiss. I'll admit 10 times over that I did say those things. Indeed, I threatened you with anything you like. Just let's not argue, for goodness sake. But how could you believe it? How could you insult me like that? Why do you want to devote all your strength to spoiling this brief moment of your presence? A stranger would be more accommodating than you are."
"That I believe.
It was no great insight. By nature, I'm as close and as accommodating to you as any stranger could get, and you know it. Then why so wistful? If all you want to do is put on an act, I'll leave momentarily.
Really? You have the nerve to tell me that, too? You're a bit too bold. After all, you are in my room. You're rubbing your fingers like crazy on my wall. My room, my wall. And besides, the things you're saying are ridiculous and not just impudent. You say your nature forces you to speak to me like that? Really? Your nature forces you? That's so nice of your nature. Your nature is the same as mine. And if I act friendly to you by nature, then you should behave no differently.
Is that friendly?
I'm talking about before.
Do you know what I'll be like later on?
I know nothing.
And going over to the nightstand, I lit the candle on it. In those days I had neither gas nor electric light in my room. Then I sat at the table for a while until I grew tired of that, too. I put on my overcoat, took my hat from the sofa, and blew out the candle. As I walked out, my foot got caught in a chair leg. On the stairs, I ran into a tenant from my floor.
"Are you going out again, you rascal?" he asked, resting on his legs, which were straddling two steps.
"What should I do?" I said. "I've just had a ghost in my room."
"You sound as dissatisfied as if you had found a hare in your soup."
"You're making fun of it, but I can assure you a ghost is a ghost."
"How true, but what if someone doesn't believe in ghosts?"
"Why, do you think I believe in ghosts? But what good does it do not to believe?"
"It's quite simple. You don't have to be afraid when a ghost actually comes to you."
"Yes, but that's only an incidental fear. The real fear is the fear of what caused the apparition. And that fear remains. I've got a whole lot of it in me."
I was so nervous that I began rummaging through all my pockets.
"Since you're not afraid of the apparition itself, you could easily have asked what caused it."
"It's obvious you've never conversed with ghosts. One can never get precise information out of them. It's like pulling teeth. These ghosts seem to be more skeptical about their existence than we are, which, by the by, comes as no surprise, considering how frail they are."
"But I've heard they can be nursed back to health."
"My, you're well informed. It's true, but is anyone going to do it?"
"Why not? If, say, it's a female ghost," he said, and swung his leg to the top step.
"I see," I said. "But even then, it's not worth the trouble."
I thought of something else. My acquaintance was already so high up that, in order to see me, he had to bend under the well of the staircase.
"But nevertheless," I exclaimed, "if you take away my ghost up there, then I'll never speak to you again."
"Oh, I was only joking," he said, pulling his head back.
"Well, then, that's fine," I said. And indeed, I could just as easily have gone for a walk.
But feeling so forlorn as I did, I preferred going back up and getting to bed.
Ja, en omdat hij zo mooi kraakt. Kraken gaat door.
Maar omdat hij zo mooi kraakt, gaan we de A-kant. Want dit is een B-kantje eigenlijk. Maar ik heb het even opgezocht. Het komt uit 1956. En het, op Discogs weten ze dat soort dingen. En nou, daar staat hij voor meer dan €100, jongens. Rijkdom. Kraken gaat door!